Welcome to the program on this Thursday morning. You know, many books have been written already about the Iraq War, but few really have captured the vivid kaleidoscope of war, the theater of the absurd that truly is war. And to do so without editorializing, but simply to lay out the reality, is no small feat. It is the work of some of our greatest war correspondents. Dexter Filkins is one of the finest war correspondents of our time, and he has accomplished all of this in his book, The Forever War. Last week, that book was awarded the National Book Critics Circle Award as the best nonfiction book of 2008. When the book originally came out, we had the opportunity to talk with Dexter Filkins about the war, about the human, not just the strategic side of the war. We're going to take this opportunity, in light of his award, to reprise that conversation. We're joined by one of the best foreign correspondents at work today. He is Dexter Filkins of the New York Times. He's reported extensively from Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq. He's written about the rise of the Taliban, was embedded with the Marines as they took Fallujah, witnessed executions on a soccer field in Kabul before 9/11, and was at the World Trade Center on that fateful day in 2001. It is my pleasure to have Dexter Filkins with us today to talk about his new book, The Forever War. Dexter Filkins, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. One of the things one comes away with in reading so much of what you've written about here, about the war on terror, is that it's a little bit like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. The idea of reporting on it, of living through these events over such a long period of time, has to take its toll on how one views this war, on how one views the whole notion of the war on terror so many years later.
Well, that's true. I mean, I've already been out there for 10 years, you know. I mean, I was, as you mentioned, I was sitting, I mean, it was almost 10 years ago to the day, September 1998, I was sitting in a, sitting at midfield in the Kabul sports stadium, you know, watching these very strange men called the Taliban that no one then had ever heard of, I mean, including me, you know, read verses from the Quran as they amputated someone's hand and then put another man to death. And it's strange to look back on that time because, you know, back then, it didn't mean anything, you know. I mean, it was sort of this kind of faraway place that no one knew much about, very strange people. And it was only, you know, it was only after 9/11 that all of that began to make sense.
Was there a sense that you had at that time, going back to 1998, that something was going on here, that you were at the beginning or witnessing something that was going to have certainly an even more profound influence than what happened at that soccer stadium?
Yeah, I did. I actually did. I mean, I was so troubled at one point that, because it just was very, very strange. It was just such a weird time, and you could see these kind of, you could see the gathering storm. I mean, of course, I didn't know what was going to happen, but I remember actually at one point, this is when I was working for the Los Angeles Times, and I called home and I said to one of my editors, I said, look, this isn't anything I can write a story about, but something bad is going to happen here. There were just too many things, and I think I called my editor that day because I had been in Kabul, and I was hearing the very strange stories about the Arabs, Osama bin Laden, that the Arabs were taking over, that they were throwing money around, that there were training camps outside of town, that there was even, that the Arabs, including Osama, used to gather for a volleyball game outside of town on Friday afternoons after the executions. So it was this kind of vague but very palpable sense that I had that, you know, this traumatized, broken country was going to demand its recognition.
And yet it also had to be hard to imagine, as you write about, that these people that were so backwards in so many ways, sort of like from another planet, as you talk about, could have the influence that they would ultimately have in the world.
It's true. I remember, now this is after the Taliban collapsed in December of 2001. I was in Kabul. And it was an amazing time to be in Kabul. You know, everybody was cheering, and you know, the women were pulling their burqas off, and men were digging up television sets that they'd buried in the ground in big plastic bags. It was a great time. But I remember then going into these Al-Qaeda safe houses that they had set up in the capital. And it was actually, you know, you could go into these houses, and there were these enormous maps. I remember there was one that said it was a very bright mural around the Middle East, and it said the infidels encirclement of the Holy Land. But for all of that, I mean, for all of that, there were some very smart people who were working on these terrible projects. You know, they weren't stupid people. I mean, the Taliban were extremely backward. I mean, you know, felt like you were in the fourth century much of the time. But the people who, you know, they had educated, whether it was Muhammad Atta, you know, or whoever else. I mean, they had people with, you know, college degrees who were working on these terrible plans.
Did you understand how little that Americans, the West in general, Americans in particular, understood about what was going on here?
Well, I mean, I don't think anybody did back then. I mean, I you know, again, looking back, it's all pretty clear. But but back then, you know, back when you're in the third world, you know, nothing is ever very good in the third world. You know, there's a you know, one day a typhoon comes and kills 15,000 people, and the next day there's an earthquake and there's too much poverty, and the governments are corrupt, and it's always like that, you know. And if you're in a place like Pakistan or Afghanistan, there's just a lot of, you know, there's a lot of misery and human suffering, and so it was hard to look at it then and say, well, this is, you know, this is something bad's going to happen very, very soon, and what is it? So in that sense, I don't think I knew any more than anybody else.
After 9/11. How did it crystallize for you, the events of that day, with what you had seen already in that part of the world?
Well, I was in New York on 9/11, right. And I got down to Ground Zero. And, you know, those first few hours as I was making my way down to Ground Zero, I wasn't thinking very much about, I don't think it clicked until later in the day, you know, as I kind of got a moment to catch my breath. I mean, I was literally standing, you know, looking into the flames from One Liberty Plaza, the building right next door, and I started to think about who did this, and it became pretty clear. I mean, I think it, you know, once I started thinking it was Osama and Al Qaeda, everything else kind of clicked. You know, all these other strange things that I had seen and heard. You know, the training camps outside of Kabul that they were said to be operating. All the people who were coming from around the world to Kabul and to Afghanistan then, and all those things kind of clicked, you know, all at once. So you know, it wasn't long after that that I got back to my office, and one of my editors walked over to my desk and said, "Hey, haven't you been to Afghanistan before?" So I was, a couple days later, I was on a plane, you know, flying for Tajikistan to make my way across the border.
Mm-hmm. Talk about that when you got back to Afghanistan after having witnessed 9/11.
Well, it was an incredible time. I mean, it was, I flew to Tajikistan, which is, you know, tiny country on the northern border of Afghanistan. And the reason why I went there was because if there was a tiny kind of, you know, it was about the size of a postage stamp, a tiny piece of territory that was still held by the anti-Taliban rebels, and you could get into it from Tajikistan. So I was literally, it was an astonishing moment. I was standing on the banks in Tajikistan, standing on the banks of the Amu Darya River, which is, at that point, it was about 50 yards across to the Afghan banks, and the little swath of territory that these rebels held was so small that, you know, the barge they had going across the river to carry supplies was within mortar range of the Taliban, and so there were shells literally dropping in to the river. As I crossed the river that day, I mean, that's how close they were, and that's how sort of thin the thread was that these rebels were hanging on by. You know, this was, if you remember, the area that was controlled by a guy named Ahmed Shah Massoud, the very charismatic, dynamic, anti-Soviet commander who'd fought against the Russians so bravely. And then he had fought against the Taliban. And if you remember, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda killed him 2 days before 9/11. They killed him on September 9th in, you know, full anticipation that once 9/11 happened, the Americans would come looking for Ahmed Shah Massoud, which, of course, they did. He was dead by then, but, of course, that became the staging area from which the Americans mounted the invasion to take out the Taliban.
Was there a sense that you had at this point that this was going to be a very long war, this war against terror that America was talking about at this point?
Well, I have... I have to tell you, I didn't get that sense, and I probably should have. I mean, I'd spent enough time there, but I was kind of hoodwinked by the first initial phase of the invasion. It was mm-hmm. such an incredible time. It was a joyous time. I mean, you could drive into these towns, as I did with the Northern Alliance in November and December of 2001, as the Taliban were collapsing. And it was just a wonderful scene. I mean, you know, watching the women literally pull the burqas off their heads, you know, men shave their beards off. I remember standing in a place called Amman's Barbershop in Talakan, and it was the Taliban had not left the town for 12 hours, and the barber his name was Amanullah, was knee deep in beard cuttings. There was a line around his shop, and he was just basically cutting men's beard off. People were happy to see the Taliban go. They really, really were, and I think to look at it now and to see how much has changed is really quite something. I mean, it's a shame, really, because Afghanistan was the good war. You know, that was the war that everybody agreed on, and in contrast to Iraq, which has been very divisive, yeah. And it's been very, very surprising to me just to see it deteriorate as it has now. I mean, the United States is now losing more soldiers in Afghanistan than it is in Iraq.
How badly has the situation deteriorated in Afghanistan?
Well, I was just on the border. I was just on the Afghan border on the Pakistani side. I went into the tribal areas, and I have to say I was pretty shocked. I mean, I know that area pretty well. And I had just gone to Iraq as well, and Iraq is much, much better. It's uh-huh. it's stabilized considerably, and so it was shocking to be on the Afghan border there and to see what's happened. And basically, what I saw was kind of one thing, but it's a very, very important aspect of the war, which is the tribal areas in Pakistan on the Afghan border are these enormous kind of untouchable sanctuaries that the Taliban have set up, and the Taliban is now using these sanctuaries not just to cross the border and attack American soldiers, but they're now using the sanctuaries to kind of go into the rest of Pakistan. And so it's a really, along the border there's 45 million Pashtuns, and they call it Pashtunistan. I mean, they don't really recognize the border there, but it's very, very difficult. I mean, I kind of stand back and look at the situation there, and I kind of scratch my head,
To what extent do you think the reaction in Afghanistan, this jubilation, this sense that you talked about before, to what extent did that inform and have an influence on what we would ultimately do in Iraq, do you think?
Well, I think it was huge. Really, I really do. I mean, it's a very good question because I don't think people talk about it very much. I mean, I think people talk about, we didn't have a plan when we went into Iraq and, WMD and all that stuff. But what I think is, they thought it was going to be easy. I thought it was going to be easy. I mean, I drove into Iraq on the first day of the invasion. I rented a car in Kuwait and I drove across the border. And I remember thinking, this is going to be like Afghanistan. We're going to roll into these towns like we did in Afghanistan. The people are going to come out and they're going to start cheering, and everyone's going to be really happy. And we're going to, the American army is going to sweep into Baghdad and knock off this government, and it'll be just like Kabul. And of course that didn't happen. I mean, I remember in my case, I mean, I had to chuck those preconceptions that I had immediately because, I mean, literally as I drove across the border, I saw this broken, traumatized. In my book, I compare it to breaking into a mental institution. And I say that with the greatest sympathy and love for the Iraqi people, but it is a broken, traumatized, destroyed country that kind of fell into our hands that day. And I don't think anybody, nobody had really thought about it in those terms. They were thinking, this is going to be like 2001. It was only like 18, 20 months before. This is going to be easy.
What was it that was different with the Iraqi people? What was different? You talk a lot in the book, in the Forever War, about trying to come to understand the Iraqi people.
Well, for me, what was different, there were two things, basically, as I try to talk about in the book. And it was a kind of a yin-yang thing for me. I mean, there was the one aspect, which I just mentioned, which is the trauma. And mm-hmm. you really cannot find an Iraqi who does not have just a horrendous story to tell you. And all these things are kind of, you know, and these are stories about, you know, my brother was taken away and disappeared. My family was killed. You know, my sister was raped, et cetera, et cetera. Just horrendous stories. I mean, and you know, a few days after the invasion, I was just driving around Baghdad with a taxi driver, and I said to him, can you take me to an interrogation center? And, you know, he kind of shrugged and said, sure. And he took me to one of these places, and there, you know, I don't know how many of your listeners have been able to stroll through a macabre interrogation center, but it is a shocking, horrendous thing to see. And all of this stuff was kind of, you know, right beneath the surface all the time, so that, as I mentioned in my book, you can literally be having a conversation with an Iraqi about something else, and this stuff just starts kind of welling up, you know. And so this trauma was kind of always beneath the surface. But that was the yin part, and I think the yang part, which was really, really heartening, and I could never reconcile it with the other part, was that, you know, for all the trauma of the place and for all the suffering and all the violence, you know, whenever the prospect of normalcy, you know, whether that was elections or peace or just, you know, having a regular life presented itself, they always lined up to take it. You know, I mean, whether that meant running for office or becoming a chief of police in a town or becoming the mayor, they always did it. And, you know, and a lot of them got killed doing it, but they did it anyway. And it was incredible. I mean, it was heartbreaking to see this stuff. I mean, there's one woman that I mentioned in particular in my book who was, you know, out running for office and absolutely determined to make her country a better place, you know. And, you know, she ended up, you know, face down in a ditch off the airport road. But and that happened a lot too. But that was, for me, that was the kind of the irreconcilable, this deeply traumatized country, but at the same time, these really, really kind of idealistic people.
You talk about Ahmet Çalabi as sort of somebody that represents, in many ways, the complexity, the intricacies of the Iraqi people. Some of this yin and yang. Talk a little about that.
Ahmet Çalabi is an extraordinarily complex guy. I mean, I think a lot of your listeners know who I'm talking about.
Right.
You know, on one hand, he's absolutely brilliant. You know, he has a PhD in mathematics. You know, he taught at University of Chicago. Incredibly hardworking. You know, he could go to his house at 10:30 at night, and he'd have the electricity grid maps, you know, spread out in front of him. Very, very charming, very warm. But at the same time, you know, keeps very strange company, you know, whether it's the Iranians or Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shiite militia commander. Obviously works on many, many different agendas. You know, it seems pretty clear that in retrospect he said a lot of things before the war that weren't true, you know, about, you know, whether Saddam had a connection with al-Qaeda or WMD. And so that was the essential contradiction of him, and in a way, it was kind of the you know, everything. It was the essential contradiction of Iraq. I mean, it was kind of everything in Iraq. You know, and I speak as a reporter who spent 4 years there. It's everything is kind of ambiguous in that way, and very, very opaque. And when you look at something or someone, you have to think very, very hard about not just what they're doing and what they're saying, but, you know, what they're doing and what they're saying when you're not looking. So it's a very, very tricky game, and to understand that place, and sort of Ahmet Çalabi, for me, was the kind of personification of that.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense of how the United States will ultimately be shaped and influenced by the events in Iraq?
Wow, that's a really good question. I mean, you know, we always talk about Iraq, you know, how are we going to get out? What's going to happen to that country? What's going to happen to the Middle East? But we don't talk very often about what the war is doing to us. I think the short answer for that is, you know, we've had, I think, more than a million different guys and women have cycled through there and Afghanistan to mm-hmm. fight. A lot of them have been deeply traumatized by this war. A lot of them, of course, have been severely wounded. And we're all going to be living with that. I think for me, what's been particularly strange about these wars, and what I think makes them different from so many of the wars that America has fought, is this kind of strange, you know, they're abstractions for most people. There's no draft, as there was in Vietnam and World War II. You know, nobody's had to pay higher taxes even to fight it. You know, there's no war bonds. There's basically, the average American hasn't had to make any sacrifice at all. And you know, this war is basically fought by, you know, 19-year-olds from North Dakota. And except for the officer corps, but that's a very small number of people. And mm-hmm. So the war, for that reason, doesn't, I think neither of these wars really resonates in a personal way for most people. It's an abstraction. It's something you argue about. And so in that sense, it's very, very strange. Most people, I think most Americans, don't really have a palpable sense of what these wars have been like. I mean, that's one of the things I try to do in my book, is to try to kind of give people a sense of what these places feel like, you know, what it's like to actually be there.
In many ways, Vietnam, although it came at a time when we had less communication, less instantaneous information, in many ways it was closer to us when we look back at it. In many ways, we had a greater sense of place. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is, you know, just to play off what I just said, which is, you know, there was a draft then. I mean, you had kind of everybody was signing up. I mean, it was a much bigger war. You know, I think America's lost about 4,500 troops after 5.5 years of war in Iraq. You know, we lost 58,000 in Vietnam. You know, at the peak of the Vietnam War, there were 550,000 American troops there. You know, at the peak of the Iraq War, it's been about 165,000. So these are you know, much different things. But I think, you know, because Vietnam was so much bigger, but also because, you know, more people had a stake in it. You know, college students went out and into the streets and demonstrated. You know, people had a real connection to the war in a way that they really don't with this war. Because it's not just a different war, it's a different military. You know, we have a volunteer military. And basically what we have is a military at war, whereas we don't really have a country that's at war.
And yet the larger framework that you talk about, the forever war, this war on terror, talk about what you see as the future of that.
Well, I think predicting the future in Iraq or Afghanistan is kind of a fool's game, and by the title of my book, The Forever War, it's not. I mean, I don't mean to take that literally. I think these wars will end one day, but like the rest of my book, it's kind of, you know, I've been out there for 10 years. That certainly feels like forever. It's already forever. But I think. You know, I've just been in both of these places, and again, it's hard to make a prediction, but if you just take the two snapshots of these places that I've just been to, Iraq was much better. I mean, I just got back from Iraq about 2 weeks ago. It's much better. It may be very fragile. It is very fragile. It may just be temporary, the calm, but the violence has dropped enormously. I mean, so much so that, you know, the life has kind of flowed back into the streets in that place. And in a way that I didn't think was possible, frankly, when I left there in 2006. It's really remarkable. And just, you know, leave the politics aside, it's just nice to see. I mean, it's nice to see the relief on people's faces. And, you know, it's nice to see that, you know, the death rate of American soldiers has dropped so much. I think, you know, the efforts there to kind of consolidate this and to kind of make it permanent. So in that sense, it's a hopeful, at the moment, it's a pretty hopeful situation in Iraq. In Afghanistan, I'm sorry to report it's not as hopeful at all. I'm glad I'm not making policy on that one. I just got back from the border regions, and that situation is deteriorating very rapidly.
Dexter Filkins, his book is The Forever War. It is just out from Knopf. Dexter, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you, sir.
I appreciate it. Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.